Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, my wonderful folks. As always, a pleasure to be on the air. Every week, I get to talk to you, sometimes new people, many times people who know me well by now, after years and years on the air and all the other things that go on that I write about and do. And again, I just want to start and say thank you for being out there. Thank you for listening. There's a lot of exciting things going on now. The public is certainly growing by leaps and bounds in its awareness of what we are doing. It was only about a year or two ago, maybe less. Maybe it was just, I don't know, seems like almost months when if I got 300 people coming to my website in a day, it sounded like a really good day. Nowadays, it's in the thousands every day coming to my website. Sometimes it's up 6,000-7,000 this week. My blogs, my latest blog now, it's probably, certainly last I looked, it was over 6,000 people that downloaded it in a day or two. It's up on MIA and on my own website. And don't forget that you can keep track of the stuff I'm doing, announcements, that you can keep track of it by going to my website, breggin.com, signing up for the free frequent alerts, and I'll keep you alert of new blogs by me, by the people who are now beginning to occasionally blog on my website. I'll keep telling you more about that as it evolves. The Honored Bloggers series. There's just a lot of interest in what's going on out there now. I don't feel like I'm speaking so much into the void. The major media, they're still really, really bad. They're worse than they were 10 or 12 years ago, ever since they started, the direct-to-consumer advertising on radio and on TV and in magazines and in newspapers. The coverage has been worse with the growing years in the major media, even as we reach out to many, many more people through the incredible internet processes. And even as the public becomes more and more aware, the media gets quieter and quieter. I think it was Kentucky, a governor just came out, though, and he warned about psychiatric drugs in the shootings. So we're getting these sporadic things happening, and they're very, they're encouraging. My latest blog was one of the best I've written, I do believe. It's called More Psychiatry Means More School Shootings. You can get to it by going to my alerts. And that'll take you right to it on Bob Whitaker's website. And also you can, as I mentioned last week, you can go to MIA, Madness in America, www.madnessinamerica.com, and you can see the series there that Bob Nickel and Bob Whitaker have put up about withdrawal from psychiatric drugs. I think there's 6 of the 7 are up now. And you can go there and hear a really good presentation that I did. One of my better ones, I think, with a really good conversation with a lot of interesting questions. So more and more is happening out there, and I may be on major media. I may be next week on major media, check my alerts, and I can't tell you too far in advance because the powers that be out there would certainly organize. So that's it for me now. I just want to let you know that things are going really, really good here. Now, let me see if my guest has arrived. Leah, are you there? Are you connected with us?
Here I am. Hello.
Hi, Leah. Hi. Could you hear my little intro?
I sure could. Hear it. Just fine.
Great. Now, Leah Ash, PhD, is an extraordinarily interesting person. Right now, she's at the University of Notre Dame, and she's at a Center for Science, Technology, and Values in South Bend. She's called a visiting postdoctoral scholar. Leah has been around the world many times in many capacities and speaks a number of languages. She has very broad interests. She does a high level of philosophic analysis in her papers, but she's also very rooted in reality. She kind of is interesting in the ways in which her philosophical and this is something I think she's very intentional about, the way her philosophical inquiries, I think she would call them more like thoughts and connections and sometimes meanderings on the relationships between things in the universe, and particularly about the nature of truth. But today, we may get into some of that, but what we're really going to be looking at is an incredible, tragic, horrific experience that she went through within the medical system in Great Britain. And this is not a show for the squeamish, but it is a show for those who want to continue to understand just how dangerous the medical psychiatric system is. As she is telling her story about how demoralizing the medical system can be in Great Britain, struggle she had to get free of it. Keep in mind that, I represent in my legal work people here in the U.S. who have been similarly abused, similarly held, and even threatened with or punished with shock treatment, which fortunately did not happen to Leah Ash. We're just going to have a conversation. Maybe Leah, you could just tell us a little bit more just about yourself in general. The studies you do are broad and interesting. You can talk a little bit about that if you want, or your interests and how you got these interests. And then we could go on with the story of what in the world happened to you. So why don't you pick up the mic?
All right. Well, thanks very much, Peter, for having me on. It's a joy to be here, and I'm grateful to be a part of this conversation. And I hope it will continue in some way or another.
Good.
A little bit about my background. I would say I don't have a conventional background in any sense. After I studied engineering in college, and that was a good long time ago now. I worked as an engineer for a couple of years, but I decided that I didn't really like it. You know, I didn't like sitting in a cubicle, staring at a computer screen, and at the end of the day, making aircraft that killed people. So I figured out how I might be able to change directions, and I did. In 2007, I won a fellowship to study in a master's program overseas. It was a master in the history and culture of food. So something like an anthropology of food, food history, and combined with studies in the history and philosophy of food and things related to it. And I studied in a collaboration between three universities in Italy, France, and Spain. So I was based in the Mediterranean for a long time.
You know, Leah, I may have you back for that subject because, as my folks know, the issue of food and its relationship to life and spirituality and nutrition is very growing importance to me. So I was very attracted by that background that you had.
Oh, but, yeah. And go ahead. I think this, especially this relationship, you know, this juncture between food and man, because food is this something special. You know, it's not a tool. It's not a god. It's this something that transcends the boundary between the sacred and the corporeal or the sacred and the material world. And it has all these kinds of specialnesses to it. Anyway, I'd love to talk about those, but maybe that's a different story.
Well, actually, could you go on and just talk about that for now? We can be spontaneous here. That's such an important subject to me, if it's okay with you. I mean, you know, let me tell you a theory I have. Let's go. Can we go off on a tangent from your story?
Let's go.
Lee and I have never met, by the way. We're meeting. We had a brief phone call earlier. I have an idea that about human bonding, that through our food at its best, our nutrition, we bond with nature, and that it has some sort of an echoing or analog with our relationships with people, which are nutritious also in nurturing us, and that there's nutrition and there's nurturing, and that food connects us to nature, often to God in many cultures, and human relationships are fundamentally at their best about nurturing and nutrition, and often in many cultures, of course, and I'm in that direction, connect us to God. We don't have to go into that if that's not where you go with it. So I think there's some real analogies between human relationship and what it means to bond with people, and human nutrition and bonding with nature, and that they're both very spiritual. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think the spiritual dimension to food is something that's essential to it. You know, so for example, you know, if we think about things, okay, let's take the most basic example, as we're all of the major religions use food in some way or another. I'll use the word communicate with God, but that's a word that I think is more limiting than I want it to be, because it doesn't just help us, let's say, to speak to God or to the otherworldly, but it helps us to somehow enter in with and let that other world enter within ourselves in a corporal way, and it's in that very corporal act that we move into a different plane of being. Right? So it's this thing that bridges these, you know, so science can think about corporality. It can think about what goes on in the body. Science doesn't deal well with spirituality because it's not knowable. This is what I call the nomos of knowability, right? So we live in this world where science has to know everything, and it can establish truths and facts and so forth. Well, I like to picture God or the God world or the spiritual world or whatever this world might be as that thing that captures the unknowability. So we put this into lots of different forms and different religions and different spiritual practices and so forth, but it's the space that can contain the things we don't know, the magic in the world. This isn't food, but look, this does relate to food. It rains or it doesn't rain, and that gives us the food. At the end of the day, this is kind of a magical act, right? We can't make it rain. We can't command it to rain. We can only respond to the rain and live within the rain, and we do that in a corporal way. You know, the rain, the God world, through the rain, as it were, through the soil, through the food, enters us, and we become a part of that world. And that world becomes, you know, a part of the spiritual world and so forth. So it is this connection of man with nature, with the world. And I mean, to take this one step too far, maybe, I even think the distinction between man, you know, as one unit and nature as another is a distinction that that, well, it's artificial, and we've applied it in this particular construction of reality that we go around using. But food is something that reminds us that it doesn't have, that's not necessary. It doesn't have to be that way. And when we eat, and when we experience it as something more than one material unit entering my corporal unit, and we realize, oh, there's something more going on here than that, we acknowledge this mystical nature to the world. Just to say, I think you're right on when you use the word spirituality to think about food.
Well, I like what you're saying. I actually think I need what you're saying. You know, I spend so much of my day in the scientific battleground, and I need what you're saying. I hope that our listeners kind of hang out with this for a few minutes. One of the things I'm fond of saying is when people are made of each other and people are made of nature. And that's another analogy. We're made of the food we eat. We're made out of the chemicals in the world around us. We're made of the people that nurture us. And some of the distinctions we make, if we could just find the way you're talking about it to bridge some of these distinctions, it could just relax us a bit and not make us so mired down in some sort of a scientific partitioning up of everything we think about. Is that sort of along your lines?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. And you know, to bring this into the very contemporary food world, a few years ago, maybe you're familiar with this one. I don't remember the name, but I'm going to say 2 years ago or so, it was real trendy because some Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, as it were, is commodified, this kind of neoliberal excess that we live in. Somebody had designed, produced. So first of all, I have a problem here with saying that we produce food and we consume food because these are artificial constructions that we apply to it. No, I say no, we eat it, we commune with it, we do these other things with it. To produce and to consume is to understand food in a limited economic way. In any case, so we've got the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. I could be a whole lot more efficient if I just get all of the food units in food, the calories, protein units, vitamins, and so forth. And we have to remember that vitamins and minerals and calories and so forth are one way we can partition up the thing that's food. Not the only way, but it's the way that science does it. And so it is a certain token of credibility that other ways of understanding it don't carry. So now we've got the entrepreneur techies in Silicon Valley, and they make up one of these drinkable beverages that contain all the food units that a human unit needs to exist. This is that the food units have to do with the human unit, but because there's nothing more than the food units, there's nothing more than the human unit. You know, so it's hard to discover personhood, being in this relationship. So the entrepreneurs, and they say, well, look at now, I can save all this time and I can work more and produce more things and more dollars and so on and so forth because I don't have to eat. I don't have to eat. I don't have to cook. And to me, this is a distorted way of thinking about you know, another way of thinking about food, and it's the way that I had experienced it before my own hell, is that it's this beautiful moment of communion and of coming together and of celebration where I come together with you, I come together with the world, I exist on a different plane. I'm not doing something functional. I'm doing something essential. And when the entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley functionalize food, they take away its essence. essentially capture all of the nutrients, the calories, the minerals, the vitamins, and so forth in a liquid. Oh, it was called Soylent. So you capture all the food units in the Soylent, and you just go about your existence, your life, as it were, drinking Soylent, and you get all of your nourishment from that. And so a futurist techno-scientific perspective, there was some enthusiasm for this. From what I would call existentialist perspective, it degrades the person out of the body.
Is the reference to Soylent, is that to the movie?
How they got the name, right.
Is that the movie about the eating of people?
That's it. I don't remember what the movie's called, but that's it. It's kind of like this...
Soylent Green.
That's right. That's it.
Folks, what that was is that it was in, you know, long post-industrial world, and it was discovered that these, I guess, Soylent Green patties that everybody was fed in the culture and society to keep them alive was actually recycled people.
Right. Wait, and there's a certain beautiful symbolism to that. Now that you're when we realize that it's recycled people, you know, to think about man as recyclable in this point to the way in which he's a functional or an instrumental unit. So just as we recycle, I don't know, the old cardboards, we can recycle the people. And it's I don't know if it's ironic or iconic that the tech, you know, the Silicon Valley tech entrepreneurs who made up the modern day contemporary moment, Soylent drinkable version, picked this name. But I do think it's representative correctly. You know, in
so that's an actual Soylent. Name of a drink that's been concocted, Soylent.
Oh yeah,
Oh my god.
The Tech Valley super.
Well, I thought you were speaking ironically when you first brought it up.
Oh no, this is a brand name from a couple years ago, two years ago, maybe.
Well, if I wasn't afraid of losing my screen, I'd go look up Soylent Green.
Right.
But I'm not facile enough with my equipment to go and Google and risk losing my technical connectivity to you. Yeah, I mean, it's the Native Americans, they had such a connection to the food they ate. And I'm not idealizing Native Americans. They had war and violence and hatred before we even arrived to spread it around or increase the intensity of it at times. But they did have some very good connection to their world in which they lived, and were much more respectful of it spiritually. And, you know, they would say prayers of gratitude to the beans that they ate, to whatever it is they ate. They would say gratitude toward it. And if they killed a deer, they would apologize to the deer and they would thank the deer. And wow, we're very remote from thanking the potato on our table for the food it gives us. And not many of us are sitting around thanking God for the food or thanking the universe or the powers that be or love or whatever for the creation of the food we eat. And I think bringing spirituality to food and to eating is incredibly important. Now, is that on? I always feel like I'm reaching to understand what you're saying because it's an unfamiliar kind of discourse for me. But am I making sense with you?
Yes, and I think I like that characterization of your response to what I'm saying. You know, I'm speaking from a point of view that doesn't want to have the answers. I want to pose possibilities and questions and let us live in that space where we can think about possibility and imagination. And so when you say, I don't know if I'm on board, let me go, let me see if I can go there and see where it takes me. I think that's a beautiful response. And I like when I enter those zones too, which is why I construct my writing that way. But anyway, so I do think we're thinking.
Thank you for that response. Go ahead.
I do think we're thinking along the same lines. I would only add that you made a good example of historic Native American relationship with food, foodways, and that's a good example. The only thing I would point out immediately is that I think what would be more interesting to say is that historically, that's the relationship that most people and most people had with food, not in the particular, right? So the Native American North American geography, has the three sisters, the corn, beans, and squash, and so forth.
Thank you for reminding me of that. I tried to remember the three sisters, and I couldn't bring them back. Corn, beans, and squash. Thank you.
That's it, right. But I suppose my point is that's because of this, this geography and this climate and the way the world happened here. And in the Arctic, it's not going to be corn, beans, and squash. It's going to be a lot of whale fat or seal fat and things like this. And in the Mediterranean, it's going to be a lot of, beans per beans weren't native to the Mediterranean regions, but chickpeas, right? Chickpeas were native. A lot of vegetables that we think of, onions and carrots, and a lot of these earthy vegetables. These made up peasant food, and these just were the relationship of the man with the earth for the longest time. My point is that there are all kinds of ways that man and men together, cultures, societies, have related to the world through their foodways. The one that doesn't is the modern Western food world. And so in a way, the world thinks of itself as kind of an advancement upon, we've mastered, we better understand food, we've understood how to produce it, manufacture it efficiently, how to consume it correctly, and so forth, according to all these schema and programs and plans. But this is the exception. We, this culture, is so far removed from the world that gives us food. Take one good example here. Have you ever eaten a fish with a head on it? What I mean. So if anybody most people in the United States that I know have never eaten a fish. Fish comes in nondescript, 1-inch high, square on a pink plate of styrofoam, wrapped in a cellophane covering, and this is fish. But fish, to parts of the world, still live in ways such that a fish that one fishes from the river or from the sea, comes to a person as a fish. And so this difference in relationality, I think, is a phenomenon that's particular to the modern West. And that's worth remembering and pointing out, I think, even more than the relationship of the Native Americans with corn, beans, and squash, or of Mesoamericans with corn, and so on.
What do you think, Leah? I'm talking about, again, folks, with Leah Ashe, A-S-H-E. She's a PhD, and she's, for the time being, at Notre Dame, but maybe moving on. What do you think it does? Trying to find language that meets your language. But what happens when
see the fish with its head on?
What do you think that does or doesn't do for us to get it packaged or to see it as a fish? Or to catch it. I mean, I used to fish. I haven't fished in a year or two since I've gone, especially since recently I've gone on the whole food, plant-based eating. I kind of have lost my appetite for torturing fish as a game, which is how I've kind of always felt about fishing. And yet whatever's built into me biologically or spiritually or whatever, I still wanted to hunt them, but I'm having increasingly less interest in that. I never could get myself to hunt. I'm going to put some decoys in the brook near my new home to see if I can attract some ducks to come live there. What happens when we, what can happen? What opens up? What potentials open up when you eat a fish with its head on or see it with its head on before you eat it?
Let me return that question to you. So as somebody who fishes...
Not anymore. I haven't fished in a while. Go ahead.
When was the last time you fished?
Probably a year. Maybe my daughter was visiting. She's a grown woman. She's not like I took a kid fishing. But she likes to fish, and probably that was the last time. Or maybe with some children a year and a half ago or 2 years ago who came to the house, and I knew they could catch some sunnies on my dock. But go ahead. What's your question?
Yeah, let me return that question to you. What happens to you when you eat that fish? How do you experience that? That I'll call it a moment rather than a consumption, because there's a lot more going on in that moment than a consumption of the food unit fish.
I have occasionally eaten the fish I've caught with, I might cut their heads off. Usually, but then I've occasionally eaten fish with their heads on. Delicatessen fish, whitefish, and other fish sometimes come with their heads on. But I think I'm aware that I'm eating a living being. Look, I don't think of it just as a creature. I think of it as as having some equivalency to me, that I'm eating a living being that I captured, killed. I'm aware of that. And of course, I'm not aware of that when I'm having smoked salmon. It's not on my mind at all, actually. But it would be on my mind if I ate a fish with a head on, and it's certainly on my mind if I eat a fish that I've caught. It makes me aware that I've made a trade of some sort with my values, or that I've taken a life, or it doesn't come lightly to me to eat the fish.
That was okay? A nice way of saying it. It doesn't come lightly to me. I don't know if you meant to imply that you have a certain sensation that you're transgressing or offending the fish. Well, how I understand what you just described to me is, in a way, a beautiful relationship. I don't want you to eat me because I don't want you to kill me. I don't want you to kill me and eat me. I don't want that. And you're respecting that. In a certain way, I get the sense, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that there's something beautifully sacrificial in the sacrifice of the fish unto you in this particular ritual. Now, that could be wrong. You know, there's a lot of work, and it's not so much my direction. I don't feel very well trying to go here theoretically, but in transhumanism, you know, how do we relate to these other creatures that fall outside the human boundary? What sort of rights and privileges and regard do they have? Does the man owe him? Any number of ways we could travel with this question, but I think what you hit on in your small description here is that there's a relationship between the man and the fish. And I haven't quite figured out all the dynamics of that relationship, what it should, what it is, what it should be, what it might be. But I think at the very first level of analysis here, there is a relationship. Whereas when you, I don't know, go to the Walmart or whatever and buy the fish and cellophane, it may have come from the lake or the ocean, but it may just as well have been produced from, you know, human, recycled human units in the Soylent sector. There's no relationality at all between man and the natural world or the animal world in the other case. And now, while some vegetarians will say, or some people of a, how would you frame an animal rights is the best label I'm coming up with, but it's not a good label here. How some people frame this is that by eating meat or by eating the fish, we're violating the other animal. And what's interesting to me is that in cultures that are closer to their animals, they're and consider them more as family. So, for example, a lot of families that I know in Italy have, say, sheep. And the sheep are kind of part of the family. You know, I knew one woman who slept with her sheep, not in that sense, just in the sense of, like, they would the little babies would sometimes crawl into her bed with her. You know, the other sheep kind of lived in her first floor. So they are a part of the family in a certain way. You know, they might have names, they might not. In these same cultures, there's much more of a facility in killing them. Now, it's not an ugly sort of killing. There's not this disregard that I think happens in our culture, right? Like in this culture, and there's factory farming and so forth, I don't know, you go zap, and it's kind of like, you know, killing the enemy. This is why I quit engineering, right? I didn't like making the warplanes. You know, you kill the enemy by sitting in an office box somewhere in Utah and pressing a button, and a drone goes and kills the enemy. You know, it's this substantiated relationship with the other that itself, you know, the distance of that relationship negates his being. It refuses to see his face. Maybe that's a good way to say it. Right? So the military killer in this sense refuses to see the enemy's face in the same way that the eater who's never imagined the cow or the fish or the sheep or the whatever, who's never imagined the other being in play here. And I think that's an interesting dynamic to the cultures that have existed and that do exist, that maintain a relationship with the animal world or the plant world or the natural world in a larger sense, from which man takes and to which man ought be then in a certain way indebted or communicated or co-involved. So in the Western world, man dominates world, uses it, takes from it, builds on it, so on and so forth. In this other way of understanding the world, man is part of a world in which there are plants and animals and things and stars and maybe gods and spirits and who knows what else. So again,
I'm just listening and just thinking along with you. Go ahead.
That's really all I'm doing here is thinking out loud along these kind of channels we've opened up here.
I'm very glad we're talking about this, and our audience has stayed with us. And thank you for staying with us. This is an unusual conversation. What I think is very special about one of the things that's very special about your approach, Leah, is obviously is they're not trying to get to a place or get to an answer, but trying to mull on things. And that's very much been my relationship to nature and to animals and to eating. And it's such in contrast to how I work as a reformer, where you know, I see children being abused and I make up my mind about it and I get some sense of what I want to do about it. And Ginger and I go to work on it. And this other world, it's like you're visiting me in my home and having an almost otherworldly conversation about things I don't understand and haven't been included about, which is refreshing.
You know, there's a Zapatista saying that, you know, we always talk about seeing the sameness in the other. You know, I see myself in you or something. This is a common thing, you know, we like to say, everybody's the same. And there's a Zapatista saying that it goes something like, welcoming the other is welcoming the otherness in the other. And I feel like we're doing that a little bit now, and I like that.
Yeah, I think that is wonderful. Could you tell me exactly who's saying it is? I hear you saying a word, but I can't make out what it is.
It's a Zapatista slogan. Zapatistas are you familiar with the Zapatistas?
No, but now I hear the word really clearly and can look it up. But okay. Who are they?
I suppose that's all. I don't want to go in that whole direction. It's something like an anarchist, anti-statist indigenous group in Mexico that would like to be sovereign. And
That's interesting. No, I haven't. I've missed out on that important part of existence. That's interesting. But I think that's really true. I think that I wrote an introduction to a book on cross-cultural counseling. It was a series of essays on cross-cultural counseling. And I said, which was kind of counter to the book, but which the editor loved, if I can find the right words for it, I said that we shouldn't think that people need their own cultural people to be counseling them. What I have found is that when somebody comes to talk with me, who is, I was thinking about a Muslim a colonel who came to see me years ago in Bethesda, Maryland, and I'm a big supporter of Israel. He was from a country that was at war with Israel, but not actively fighting. And he came to see me and had to be secret because he couldn't come to see a therapist or a psychiatrist or he'd lose his high-ranking status. And what I found was that I just paid so much attention to what he was saying that I was fully engaged with him, knowing I had to listen with special care to understand exactly where he was coming from. And I had wanted to tell him I was Jewish on the first day and that I supported Israel. And we were so engaged, in part because of my effort to understand, which I did not find difficult, what he was struggling with from his own culture. And it took me three sessions to finally say to him, listen, I haven't told you yet, for goodness sakes, and I just got to interrupt this marvelous flow. I just wanted you to know that how much I'm enjoying you, but you should know that I'm Jewish and that I'm that I really support Israel. And I know our countries are at war, those countries are at war. And he looked at me very sternly and he said, do you go to temple? I said, no. He said, well, you should. He said, a man should go to temple, to his church or his temple. And then we just went on and we never came back to it again. I think it's important to think about looking for the other. And that's the creative part of us, you know. When we're full functioning, we're very other. I think when we're suffering a lot, we get less of ourselves, maybe in some ways. And that when we're really feeling loved and loving and we're feeling our full selves, then we are just so, so different. And yet we have shared things. But I'm done. Go ahead.
Well, listen, I know we went off on this food path for quite a long time. I don't
We
want
should
to
stay on
dominate
it.
the
I don't want to go
conversation.
anywhere else. Why
Oh.
don't we just stay on this conversation wherever it goes? This has been great.
All right. I was going to say, go ahead and relead me if I've taken a path, a different path
No,
that you
I want
want.
to stay where we are. And people are happy with it, I can tell from the numbers. So let's just keep thinking about this. We're talking about subjects that it's that we're really exploring, that can be confusing, that we don't have answers for. And they have to, so much of it has to do with valuing others, valuing life, valuing animals, valuing vegetables and plants, and the wind in the air, and where, what is our relationship to all of that? I tend to come up with a phrase or an idea like, well, we're human beings, we're made of each other, we're made of mother's milk, we're made of each other's bodies through sexual intercourse, and then we're born. And then I say, I take a deep breath and I don't go a lot further. And I hear you wanting to open it all up and go a lot further. Your thoughts?
The problem is that I've opened the door and I see a lot of space out there. I don't know where to go. here's one direction I keep coming back to. And it does draw upon the other in this sense. It's that ultimate unknowability of the other. And this theme of unknowability is really central to my work because it contradicts, it runs contrary to the ethic of modern thought, which is to know. And in the other, there's always something that we can't know because I am not him. The only reality that I can really know, okay, well, here's something. You'll like this one, I think. Speaking of knowing the other, knowing the only reality, this is what took me in this direction. The only reality that I can really know is that I live. That's what I know the truest. Right. So I know here that these are my fingers. I'm touching my fingers right now. Okay. But this I know. All the other things are abstracted to some degree, greater or lesser. Right. There are things I can know with more or less closeness. The other I can't know. I can love him. I can receive him. I can relate to him. However we want to frame this interaction relationship with the other. But I can't know him. And to be comfortable in that not knowing, and indeed to appreciate it, to revel in that not knowing, in that otherness, I think is a beautiful thing. A tangent here that in a way relates, just about the immediacy, again, of food. If we go to the, let's say, Italian, because it's easier to me, the sapore-sapere connection. And so sapore is to taste. Sapere is knowledge, to know. And so there is this very close historic relationship between tasting and knowing. And we can even think about this, you know, if you want to go to, would it be Talmudic terms or something? Like the taste of the tree of knowledge. Now, there is a certain sense in that it's in tasting the world that we come to know it most directly. And in fact, so here's another thing that draws right upon that same thing. You know, in the medieval era, there's a hierarchy of senses. In our era, too, there's a hierarchy of senses. So science sees things. We have x-rays and graphs and so forth. We visualize things. There's this privileging of the visual. The eye is sight, is the highest sense. In the Middle Ages, the hierarchy was upturned. The way that man could know something most directly was by taste, because it was the only way that man incorporated the world into himself. And so it was in that act of incorporation that he knows himself. And so maybe in the same sense, I think, intercourse, the way of knowing the other in this sense, is at once a bodily communion with the other and a cognitive communion with the other. And if we could construe our relationship with the world in the same sapore, sapere, to taste, to know juncture, it might help us to reframe some of these conversations and ideas, with the frames that we use to think about food, for example, or to think about the other. You know, it's in touching the other that, in a way, he becomes me, I become him. In taking the food, that I enter with it, it enters with me. Again, I'm just playing out these ideas in their very incipient forms here, but maybe you can see kind of where I'm going, and I don't know where they take you.
Well, the imagery I've had on and off as you were talking of some of the issues surrounding the Holy Sacrament and their theological discussions about it, the body of Christ and whether you're actually incorporating the body of Christ. It gets to that level, and I think the importance of it isn't Catholicism and the particular rituals there, but but of the issue, that issue of taking in and being like and becoming like and of eating and spirituality and God, they're just all around human existence. And this is the first time I've talked about them at this kind of length. It's interesting to have a conversation like this on the air.
Right, it's kind of an exploratory conversation that's being broadcast, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like I got the mic on the kitchen table and everybody else has gotten up from the table is what I was afraid of, but our audience is actually not only stayed, it's gotten a little larger as we've gotten toward the end. I was afraid people would, you know, I had the image of, we're talking at the dinner table, everybody else got up. But
well, I hope they did the dishes while we were still talking.
Did you actually do dishes?
No, I said I hope somebody else did the dishes.
I was thinking you got up and did some dishes. Golly. It also reminds me of something I've told my listeners about, which is Ginger and I invited Ginger's mom to come live with us. And God, I hadn't thought of this before, but we were taking her out of a bad situation, and it took all of us a while to realize that this wasn't the mother-in-law coming to live with us. This was Ginger's mom and somebody I love a lot, and we were going to be living together. That even if she had a separate apartment, which we just happened to have in the new house we bought, like God's hand, that we were going to be living together, not separately at all. And she could keep the extra space if she wanted it that was intended for the quote the mother-in-law suite, which we bought by chance along with the house that we're moving into, but that she was going to live in the house with us. It's our house. And we're talking about the our house concept in a way. And talking about unknowable, I'm getting to know my wife, Ginger, and I call her my mom, Jean, in all new ways, seeing them together and relating to them. And I'm actually getting to know myself in new ways. So and the unknowable of this experience kind of fits with the general conversation we're having. So there's another place to take it to. Oh, and four animals. Okay. Yeah, we have four animals with us, starting with a Yorkie and going up to a collie, big collie, big, strong, wonderful collie. Go ahead.
Well, what you pointed to as unknowable, I would, I suppose, bring back. Now, there's always going to be a tension between what's unknowable and what's knowable, but also between unknowing and knowing. So just as there are some things, there's some extreme at the end of the spectrum that we cannot know, I cannot know. At the same time, there are different places on that spectrum that I can get, I can become more familiar with, I can know better by becoming closer to them physically. And also, you know, in that physical closeness, also becoming closer to them cognitively. And it sounds to me like what you're describing as unknowable is, in a certain way, your process of coming to know better, no, not to know fully and completely your mother-in-law and her reality and this world's reality, but of coming to know something more than you knew before, something bigger than you knew before. Your world has enlarged in a certain way. And the word I use too much, I think, but I think it's a good one here too, is I think that's beautiful. You know, I think that's, the human vocation or the human existence or something. You know, this is the satisfaction of our being. It's not in producing more widgets. It's this kind of enlargement of our world and a coming closer to fullness or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, we're down probably to about 3 minutes to go, folks. I wish this is a show that I wish we could have audience participation in, but it probably would have been very hard to keep the flow while doing that.
Well, you know, one thing I would say is you can tell I don't have any answers, but I have a lot of questions and I like to think. And I always say, you know, I welcome any and all kinds of conversation. So if anybody wants to track me down, I'm sure you can figure out how to do that.
Give a hint, because it wasn't easy. I kind of got stuck trying to get your scientific your professional articles. How should people track you down? Leah Ashe, L-E-A-H-A-S-H-E, Ashe with an E on it. How do folks get to find you to have a conversation?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn or on Academia. Just plug in my name and you'll find me. Alternatively, if you do a Google search, I'm sure you'll find me. The other thing is I'll happily give you my information, and if you'd like, you can put it on your archive.
Okay. Leah Ashe, thank you so, so much. We come to an end with the music of Vangelis, and it's been a joy to get to know you on the air. I hope all of you have enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. And just God bless you all. And I'll talk to you in a week again. Bye.